So thank you, everyone. It is indeed a pleasure, an honor to be here at the Jewish Community Center, the Institute for Learning. It's great to be a part of the program. It's my first opportunity, so I'm very, very pleased, and thank you for coming out this morning. We, of course, wrapped up the marvelous Jewish holiday of Purim last week, but we are still in the Jewish lunar month of Adar. And the rabbis tell us, "Mishenichnas Adar marbin besimcha," that when the month of Adar comes, our joy increases. And therefore, I thought it very appropriate to look back just a few days before, where we were in the throes of enjoyment of Purim and the Hamitash, and to perhaps have a little bit of a retrospective of some of the themes of Purim of the month. And I want to connect them this morning specifically with the events of our world that we're in now. Unfortunately, the world is a very dark place in terms of terrorism, in terms of our beloved Israel. It's not a happy situation. And I believe that if we look in the Torah, in Tanakh, we can see many sources to help us better understand the matziv, the situation that we are in now, and perhaps how we arrived in the situation. So what I'd like to do this morning, and the class we have titled The Powerball Lottery of Life. No, I'm not going to give you the next Powerball secret numbers. If I had that power, I would wave a wand and give them to you. But what I would like to do is explore from the Torah, from the Bible, the Genesis, the beginnings of virulent anti-Semitism that has become such a plague in our world, France, Denmark, Middle East, and sadly even here in our own United States of America. We have some extra handouts over here. So what I'd like to begin with is a quote here, source one, in your little packet. And what source one is, it's a quote to us that comes courtesy of the book of Devarim of Deuteronomy. And it is very familiar to those who perhaps were in their temples, their synagogues, on the Shabbat, the Sabbath preceding the holiday of Purim. It's a special Shabbat. It's called Shabbat, the Sabbath of Remembrance. Shabbat Zachor. And these are the three verses that are a biblical command to us to remember a nefarious nation called Amalek and what Amalek did to us. And in these three verses, it's going to really give us a prism through which to understand, I believe, our world today. So let's examine these three verses in the English. The Hebrew is there for your enjoyment. Source 1. Zachor, it says, you shall remember et asher asah lecha Amalek, what Amalek did to you, baderech, on the way, betzeitchem mimitzrayim, when you went out of Egypt, what we call the Exodus from Egypt. Asher korcho baderech, how he happened upon you on the way, and he cut off all the stragglers at your rear. When you were faint and weary, the Jewish people, and he, Amalek, did not fear God by this attack. And then now comes the command specifically to the high court of the Jewish people and to the future kings of Israel. Therefore it will be in the future, when the Lord your God grants you respite from all your enemies around you, ba'aretz, in this land, asher Hashem Elokech noten lecha nachalah, the land of Israel that God gives to you as an inheritance to possess, lirishta, to possess, what shall you do? Timchet zecher Amalek, you must obliterate the remembrance, the memory of Amalek, mitachat hashamayim, from under the heavens, from beneath the heavens, lo tishkach, you shall not forget. So let's discuss the context of what happened.
Jewish people are riding high. We have just left Yul Brynner and Pharaoh and the people of Egypt. They have not had a happy ending at the Red Sea. They were no more. The nation was gone. We come out into the desert, into the Midbar. It was supposed to be a direct, do not stop but go, do not collect $200, go to Sinai, get the Torah, and from Sinai, directly to the promised land of Israel. That was the plan. Now we know, sadly, it did not work out that way. We had a 40-year hiatus in the wilderness. But what happened along the way? Amalek, this nation, this little weird cultish tribe, happened along the way. Now, how did this manifest itself? Because we are told that the Jewish people, as it said in the verses, were weary, they were tired, there were stragglers at the back, and this little nation of Amalek came and they attacked us. They didn't succeed in doing any serious damage to the people, because they were only able to attack those who were exposed at the rear of the camp as they moved, as they journeyed. The people, who the rabbis say were perhaps a little bit lacking in the observance of God's laws. And therefore, they did not have divine protection at the time. We know that there were clouds, what they call the Anane HaKavod, the seven clouds of glory, above, below, on each side, and one as a GPS unit, a God positioning satellite system, to help us navigate the travels. And those clouds were a shield to protect us from the heat. So if it was a very hot day, you had a little air conditioning with inside the confines of those clouds. It smoothed the way. If there were any poisonous scorpions, spiders, or snakes, they were eliminated as we journeyed. It was a wonderful journey. So when the Amalekites came, they came at a place called Rephidim, and they attacked with zero chance of success, because a vast, vast majority of the Jewish populace was within the confines of God's protective cloud. So anything you shot at the cloud, you had like a Scud missile, for example, you shot it at the cloud would simply absorb it and evaporate it. There was nothing. However, those who were perhaps derelict in their observance of some of the laws of the Torah, those people were necheshalim. They were the stragglers at the back, and they were attacked by the Amalekites. What was the response? Moses prays. Joshua, his greatest student, leads the army, and we vanquish the Amalekites. We win the day. So it was literally a suicide mission from the perspective of the Amalekites. So this is the context of what was. What I'd like to do now is, in number two, the second source, explore why. Why on earth were the Amalekites, number one, specifically choose this point in the Exodus process from Egypt to attack? If they had no chance of success and it was a suicide mission, to what effect? Why? And this will perhaps give us insight into our own world. I believe it answers up suicide bombers all over the world who've tragically become a blight for our brethren living in Israel, in our own men and women fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan and everyone else in the world, and ISIS, all of that. All of these terrorists in the world, they're all sourced, I believe, right here from these verses in our Torah, in our Bible. So let's examine what Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, the great medieval biblical Torah commentator, has to say about the Torah's description and its narrative of the attack of the Amalekites at this point in the journey forth from Egypt. So let's have a look at what he says. How he happened upon you on the way. Stop. Now we know that things don't just happen. So if it happened, Rashi is desperate to understand the Hebrew biblical word karcha, the Torah's Lashon HaKodesh, holy tongue, Hebrew. It's a description somehow of what Amalek actually tried to do if he, quote unquote, happened. And God is giving us this explanation, he's giving us an insight into the nature of what was the mindset, what motivated them, what did they attempt to effect. So let's look at the words of Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. The Hebrew word korcha, and he's desperate to understand, what does that word mean? It has many different connotations. Have a look. Number one, he says, is an expression denoting a chance occurrence. From the word in parentheses, mikra. It's been mikra. It happened. Coincidence. He happened upon you. That's one possibility. Another explanation, and I skipped a middle explanation. Another explanation offered by Rashi, it's an expression denoting heat and cold, like the word kar. Something is cold. Kor. It's cold. Heat and cold. Heat and cold. He cooled you off, the Amalekites did, and made you appear tepid, not hot anymore, after you were boiling hot, for the nations of the world were afraid to fight you, just as people are afraid to touch something boiling hot. But this one, the Amalek little tribe, came forward, started, and showed the way to others. This can be compared to a pool of boiling water into which no living creature could descend, and of course you would add the addendum, without severe bodily harm. Along came this crazy, irresponsible individual, this man, and he belly flopped. He jumped right in, headlong into this pool of boiling water. Although he scalded himself badly, he was taken away with third-degree burns to the hospital, he succeeded to make others think that it was cooler than it really was. So let's examine the commentary that Rashi just gave us. Two different ideas, disparate ideas, which I believe are interrelated. So what was the idea of asher korcho? That he happened upon you. That was explanation one. Chance. Coincidence. What I believe happened was Amalek made a PR statement, a public relations statement. Here are the Jewish people riding high on the kosher hog. Okay, we are invincible. We have just vanquished, with God's and Moses' help, the singular superpower of the world, Egypt. They're no more. And we're walking high and mighty with good reason. We're literally living with the protective cloud of glory. We have manna, literally food from heaven every day for our meals. Can you imagine? Wow. And Amalek comes along, this little cultish little footnote of a tribe, very small, and they attack. No hope of success, but they had a hope of making a very large statement, both to us, the Jewish people, and to the world in general. And what was their statement? You think, you Jews, you're such hot stuff. And I'm quoting from Rashi because it talks about heat. You're such hot stuff. You got out of Egypt. God specifically remembered you and Abraham, your great-grandfather. After all these years, he kept his word. He brought you forth from Egypt. You guys are the best, right? Huh. I'm going to show you another spin on your history, your short-lived history. You think that you are hot and that God remembered you divinely and now this is your moment and you're in the protective shield of God. Really? You think that this is a reality? Well, let me show you an alternative way of processing your short history. What if it was just coincidental? What if the events of the immediate past that happened on Passover, and you think it's so great, what if it just happened? Because, you know, stuff happens. And I'm going to show you this right now. I'm going to attack you when you are invulnerable to my attack. You are at the zenith of your existence. One's Canadian, one's American, but I'm Canadian, so I never quite remember which one. You are at the zenith of your existence. You are at the peak of your powers. You're in the cloud of glory, and I can't really get you, but I'm going to touch you nevertheless. This is what they call a public relations statement. That's all it is, because there's no chance of success. So what does Amalek, this little tribe, try to do to us? He says, look, I understand I can't get you right now. You're in the cloud. But you will not always be protected by God's cloud, will you? There may come a time in the future where my great-grandson, the man with the triangle hat, Haman from the story of Purim, he's going to come at a time when you're in exile. You're living in Persia, Iran area, and you're going to be under the jurisdiction of a despot named Ahasuerus, the king, and you won't have any clouds protecting you. And you know what? Maybe my great-grandson, Haman, he'll have a better chance of getting you. And you know what? If he doesn't work, maybe another one of my descendants, Adolf Schicklgruber Hitler, Yimach Shemo, maybe he can get you, because you will not always be protected by those clouds. That was the statement of the coincidental attack that is ascribed to Amalek. Now, let's step back from that for a moment. So what was Amalek trying to effect? To demoralize the people. To say, wait a minute. Number one, you Jews, not so high and mighty, are you? And then Rashi added an addendum that in the eyes of the world now, our relationship with our Creator was cooled off. Meaning, emotionally, we, the Jewish people, felt, oh, wait a minute. I thought we're supposed to be like the chosen people, and we're in the clouds of glory, and we're on our way to the Sinaitic covenant, the revelation, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, all this great stuff. And here, this little crazy cult, this little tribe called Amalek is able to attack us? What? How can this be? And it was demoralizing. It had a terrific, successful, if you're Amalek, impact of cooling off our relationship with our Creator. This is the second explanation of Rashi. So through the coincidence of the attack, Amalek is able to destroy the morale of the Jewish people. But more than this, we learned a crazy story, that there was this overheated pool, this crazy individual jumps into the pool, is taken away to the emerge with third-degree burns. Now, think about it for a moment. This doesn't really make a lot of sense, does it? Because think about it. If I see a pool which I believe to be overheated and potentially life-threatening, all this individual did by jumping in is what? Is prove the point, right? When I see him carted away by the paramedics in the ambulance, I'm like, oh my gosh, I thought it, I believed it was so. Now it's proof, right? So it should be that by Amalek jumping in and getting there, carcasses given back to them by Joshua and the army, the rest of the world should have responded how? We thought the Jewish people were hot stuff, and the Amalekites jumped in. Now we have the proof. Look at my gosh, they were all killed. Joshua just wiped them all out. All the men are gone. The army is decimated. But that wasn't the effect, was it? What was the effect, Rashi says? The world said, oh, wait a minute. Oh, I understand now. The Jews will not always have divine protection. And I thought they were untouchable. But if this little schleppy tribe named Amalek have the chutzpah, the audacity, to reach out and touch the Jews, unsuccessfully so, sure. But now it has entered my mind that the possibility is real. I never thought of lifting a finger against the Jews after Egypt was decimated. But if Amalek can do it, maybe I can do it. And so thought the nations of the Canaanites, the Canaanim, and the descendants of Esau, the Edomites. They all got courage from the attack of the suicide mission of Amalek. Now, this relates to us directly today, I believe, in 2015, in such a profound way. Let's just step back for a moment. Those of you who perhaps were at the Lunch and Learn with Dr. Fahmy a few months back, brilliant man, he explained something I'd never thought of, that when you see the ISIS people with their videos, now remember, it's all a public relations effect. That's all it is. Remember he explained, why are they wearing the orange? Because they're speaking to the Americans, specifically to the people of the Bush regime and now the Obama regime, as they see it, who used to dress up the terrorists in Guantanamo Bay in what color outfits? orange. Did you ever notice that they always have the orange outfits before they kill these poor people? That's by design. That's Amalek saying, wait a minute, I'm speaking to you now. I may be a little crazy cultish tribe, that's all they are, but I am bigger beyond words because I'm going to use the media and I'm going to use all the technology of today to get word out, to show you. It's all a public relations ploy. And tragically, it has worked very successfully. Look how wonderfully, from their point of view, they're recruiting from all over the world. Because people see the videos, they get encouraged. Now let's step back a little farther. There was a time before 1993-94 where we, the United States, was a little bit like Israel. No one messed with America. All right, fine, there was some situation tragically in Beirut where Marines were killed, were murdered, if you recall. But by and large, American soil was sacrosanct, wasn't it? But then there was the original Ryder truck bomb that they attempted to bring down the Twin Towers with. Do you remember this? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we know on 9/11 what happened tragically to those towers. Now, what were those towers? You may not be aware of this, maybe you are, but they were the symbol of freedom and America. It was a symbol more than anything else, more than the White House, more than the Capitol building or the monuments. This was the symbol, the Twin Towers of America's supremacy. And when they brought those towers down the second time they attacked, that was a PR statement, an Amalekite statement. It was literally a suicide mission, as you remember, flying planes in, no different than what the Amalekites did. And it was all designed to what? To bring down the morale, to crush the morale of the world, of the free world. And it was devastating. And in fact, do you remember that day? You were all there. You saw the video. Do you remember feeling this desperation, this sense of, oh my gosh, what will be tomorrow? How many other planes are there? What will be my future? It demoralized America in a very, very profound way. This is Amalek. This is what they tried to effect if that attack in the Bible, in the Torah, and Rephidim. This is what ISIS has done. Now think of ISIS. Who is that? Where did it begin? A couple of people got together and they started making propaganda videos like Joseph Goebbels, Yimach Shemo, the Nazis. And all of a sudden, with the proliferation of the internet, they have access to everyone in the world. It's almost remarkable what they've been able to achieve with such little actual tachlis. There's very little to them. Now they've had recruits, sure. I read actually yesterday, the day before, good news, that they are actually taking severe losses now. Good news. Because they're really not such hot stuff. It's an illusion. But in today's day and age, what's more effective? Do you need reality or simply an illusion of what reality might be? And this is what I believe the Torah is speaking to. Rashi is actually talking to this. That the attack of the Amalekites against the Jewish people was both to demoralize the Jewish people and to encourage the terrorists of the rest of the world to step up to the plate to destroy the Jews. They were successful in both counts. Now, in the Jewish angle, it only had a temporary impact because we all were brought back to God and we repented, it says, at that point. We realized we had questioned God and His involvement in our lives, and it led us to Sinai and to get the Torah. What happens when a suicide bomber, God forbid, Pelas Satan should happen anymore, but when they would go off in Israel, Ben Yehuda Street, what was the effect? Not that I can take Israel down. How can you take Israel down with one person blowing themselves up in a Zabaros pizza shop? You're not taking the nation down. Baruch Hashem, Israel was a very powerful country, but what was the impact on the morale? You are not alone. You're not safe in your malls, in your restaurants. I can touch you there. Exactly what Amalek said. But what was the effect for the Jewish people, for us, of every attack that has been perpetrated against our people? When our three boys were taken and murdered in the West Bank, in Israel, the three yeshiva young men, what was the response of the Israelis? And what was the response here in the diaspora? Unity. We didn't worry whether a person was Orthodox, conservative, reform, unaffiliated, Hasidic, whatever. You're a Jew. You take our boys. We're going to go to war for that. We did. We fought a war in Gaza this summer for those three boys. Every time Amalek steps up against us, it actually is counterproductive from the Amalekite vision of this world, because what does it do? It unites us. What happened when the Amalekite Haman stepped up to the plate in Purim? What did it do? It united the Jews who were a disparate, as the words of Haman, I'm quoting right now from the man in the triangle hat. He says to the king, they're just scattered all over. They don't have any identity. They're not unified. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Haman, because of your letter. They say in the Gemara and the Talmud that when the king Ahasuerus takes off his ring, hands it over to Haman and says, do your worst. That moment brought more people to return to God than any of the words of the greatest prophets in history. That had the impact. And so you know a little secret? Don't tell our enemies. That if they would just leave us alone, we have more tsuris, more strife, tragically, living together interpersonally, whether it's in Israel or outside of Israel. But when the enemy, when the Amalekites attack us, we drop all pretense of separation and we unite together. And it's a blessing ultimately for the Jewish people. It was a blessing ultimately, the original attack from the Jewish perspective, because it brought us Sinai and Israel eventually. And every time they attack us, wherever that is, we unite as one. And we really need now the rest of the world to buy into this. And the attacks, the tragedies, the horrible massacres in France and Denmark, the world's waking up. The world understands now. And the Amalekite type of propaganda, yes, it's effective to a limited extent. But if it serves to galvanize the Western world against this real terrorist threat, maybe it's something that ultimately we don't know, because we're only living a part, a snippet of the history. But maybe when it plays itself out, people will point back and say, you know, they erred. They overreached by attacking Jews and by attacking newspapers and by attacking people in different places in the world. It galvanized, it woke up the West. They were sleeping, really sleeping. But now they're awake. And in the end, God willing, with God's help, we will triumph. And I wanted to share that with you for the first half of today's class. So that's good news, right? Now let's talk about something specific to the Megillah, which is part two of what I want to share with you, which is the name of the class, the Powerball Lottery of Life. So if you would turn to your second page, please. So let's get into the Megillah itself, the Book of Esther. We now know the context. We know where Haman came from. We know what empowered Haman, what he hoped to effect, annihilation of the Jewish people. Now let us try to understand something amazing that the Megillah presents. The Book of Esther presents to us something so stunning that when you first see it, it shakes you. It really, and I hope that will have a positive effect on us today. The beginning of the Megillah, and I'm just going to quickly contextualize, we have this lavish 180-day party, unprecedented in the annals of the world. And at the end of the six-month party, the new king Ahasuerus, in the third year where he cemented his throne, and it was huge PR. He wanted to convince everyone, I'm the real deal. I'm the new Nebuchadnezzar. I'm the new Cyrus of Persia. This was the vision for the Ahasuerus rule. And what happened? His wife, Queen Vashti, in one moment of stupidity where he asked her to come to the party and she refused him, she destroyed all the grand vision that Ahasuerus had to cement the population, 100% unanimous poll numbers. Unprecedented. What happened? She says, I'm not coming to your party. Not only am I not coming, you're an idiot for even inviting me to come. It's beneath me, your queen, to parade me in front of your drunken friends to show my beauty off? Really? My grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, now he was the real deal. If you were living in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, my grandfather, you're a stable boy. You're cleaning the manure out in the barns. You're nothing. And of course, the king is shell-shocked with his wife's disgraceful response to his order to appear before him. So he turns, he says, what do I do? And he asks, it says, the seven great advisors of Persia, what do I do? And there's one man among them who has a triangle hat, small one though at this point. And he's not even called by his name Haman. He's called by a euphemism, a nom de plume, you know, like a fake name. And he's called not Mark Twain, but that's a very famous pen name. Not Mark Twain, but he is called Memnuchan. And he stands up and he says, "Your Royal Highness, not only has your wife's disgraceful behavior embarrassed you personally in the monarchy, but every man in the kingdom and the realm will think, oh my gosh, my wife will now get feminist ideas in her mind, and she's going to want to have equality in the vote. We don't know where it's going to run. But Your Royal Highness, you must take drastic action. Get rid of the queen." You don't need congressional approval, by the way, Your Honor. Your Royal Highness, just use the power of the throne and say, "Off with their head, it shall be done." So he turns to Memnuchan, Haman, and he says, "Really? You mean I don't even have to go to that annoying Congress and ask them for approval?" "No, no, no. Just say the words, 'Off with their heads.'" "Oh my gosh, can I really try this?" "Okay, off with the queen's head." All of a sudden the guys appear, they take the queen, we never see her again. Opening the door, of course, for Esther to come save the day in the future of the Jewish people in Shushan. Now, who is Memnuchan? Have a look at source 3. So in the Talmud, in Tractate Megillah, the Megillah, of course, the word like for Esther, the scroll, where else could it be, because it relates to Purim, tells us like this: "And Memnuchan said, 'Off with the queen's head,' basically. It was taught Memnuchan was none other than Haman. Well, then why don't we just call the man Haman? No, no, no. He was called Memnuchan, meaning prepared, Muchan, because he was prepared for destruction. He was prepared to take a fall. Now, what does this mean? We're going to come back to this. There is an amazing piece of oral tradition that tries to explain to us how our world really works, God and the people of the world. Listen to this midrash. It's source number 4. The oral tradition, the midrash, says that the world we live in is really like a horse and God is its rider. So you might think that the horse, which has majestic thousands of pounds of hoof power, of horsepower, of majestic, beautiful horse with the 4 legs. If you would be someone from outer space looking and you see a little man who's riding this beautiful secretariat, this man of war, majestic horse that he's riding on, you might think that the horse is going where it wants to go and that the horse is putting forth all of the energy. But if you want to know who guides whom, the rider, God meaning, guides the horse, not the horse taking the rider. Okay? Now, what is so unique about this? What is so unique about this is it explains to us something very profound, I believe, that we put forth, and we even use, by the way, this measure, interestingly, as a measure of energy. How do you measure your Corvette or your Bentley or your Ferrari's power? You call it horsepower. We even do this today. No one has any idea why we even call it horsepower, because today we don't have horses and buggies anymore. But there actually is a mathematical formula for how much power a horse can do in a specific amount of time, and therefore we measure it called horsepower, right? So anyone here who has the car, you say, how much horsepower does that Ferrari have, right? So the world gives off horsepower. Now, what is the horsepower in our analogy here? You know what it is? It's what we, human beings, put forth in our efforts in this world by living life. We expend our energies, good and bad, and that energy in this mashal, in this parable, is the horsepower that we put out there. But then God is the rider. God says, well, I like the fact that you're giving me all this energy, but I'm going to harness the energy and I'm going to put it forth the way I want it. So it's going to go here and here, but not there. We will come back to this, and I believe you're going to see it in a shockingly profound way, how it interrelates, okay? Let's go to source 5. At the most critical time in the book of Esther, reluctant Queen Esther is afraid to go to ask the king, Ahasuerus, to save her and the Jewish people from imminent genocide at the hands of Haman. Because Haman has set it up that the king, Ahasuerus, is a paranoid lunatic at this point. He's scared of everybody, scared of his own shadow. And he has sequestered himself in his inner chamber, and there's a rule that the Secret Service agents, the guards who guard the palace gates and the inner chamber, the sanctum of the king, have orders to shoot and ask questions later. Unless there is an official invite, an invitation given, you dare not intrude upon the king's domain. So Esther points this out to the chief rabbi of Shushan, her cousin Mordechai. She says, but Rabbi Mordechai, I can't go in to see the king without permission. I haven't seen him for over a month. Could be that I've lost favor with the king. I will lose my head, even me, the queen. All right. Now, if you are Mordechai, and you want to give words of encouragement to a reluctant queen, who's scared, and rightly so, about her own life, you probably would not use the words that Mordechai uses. Have a look at the words that he says to her in response to her worry and her doubts. Listen to what he says. Number 5. For if you, Queen Esther, remain silent at this time, meaning where the Jewish people are in peril, relief and rescue will arise for the Jews from elsewhere. It means we're going to be saved from somewhere else. And you and your father's household will perish. And who knows, my beloved Esther, whether at a time like this you will attain the kingdom. Maybe you became the queen specifically for this moment in time. I'm not sure, only God could know. Now, this is not what you would want to give as a pregame speech to someone to encourage them to go. Because think about it for a moment. What was Mordechai essentially saying to Esther? Do we need you or not? No. Go or do not go? It's your question. It's your problem. It's not the Jewish people's problem. If you don't go, stay home. But know one thing. The Jewish people will survive Haman and his nefarious plot. I don't know how, but God has preordained that the Jewish people will overcome this potential catastrophe. Now, why would you say that to the queen? You should think, oh my gosh, we're desperate. Please, Esther, it has to be you and no one else. You're in a unique position. Maybe that's why you became queen. Don't tell her, well, okay, fine, don't go. But know that if you don't go, you're a goner on a personal level. Don't tell her those words. Why would Mordechai say to the queen, we don't really need you? Seems like a very strange pregame speech to give to empower your team to success, right? So what's going on? Let's get back to source number 4. The oral tradition taught us that the world, the energy expended by the Jewish people and the nations of the world, is measured like horsepower. It's the horse. And who's riding on the horse? God is the rider. And he takes all of our energies, means we pray, we try our best to effect change, and we put forth all this energy towards God. But ultimately, God takes our cumulative energy, and he guides and directs where and how the energy that we put forth will be used, right? Is there someone in the Megillah, someone in the Book of Esther, who actually literally articulates this midrash? There actually is somebody. You know who it was? Haman. Haman says exactly what this piece of oral literature taught us. Do you remember the crazy scene where it's the middle of the night and the king's not sleeping? And the king just found out, because they were trying to put him to sleep with the boring Guinness Book of Chronicles of records from his palace, and he can't sleep. And they just told him, by the way, there was a plot years ago against your life by two crazy guys named Bigson and Seresh. They were guards. They wanted to poison your food. But luckily for you, Mordechai the rabbi got wind of the plot and he saved your life. And the king says, well, how did I reward him? Did I give him 1,000 shares in Apple? Did I give him a new Ferrari? No, bupkis, nothing. You gave him nothing. And the king is outraged. How could it be that you saved the life of of the king, and there's no reward that diminishes my effect. I mean, how can you say the life of a king? What does that mean if the king doesn't reward this? It means the life, the value of the king's life is meaningless. It's nothing. So he's outraged. And Haman has come in the middle of the night, and he's out there in the courtyard, in the chatzer, and he's waiting anxiously, because he's got to ask permission from Achashverosh, because he's so anxious to kill the Jews, and specifically Rabbi Mordechai, that he can't wait till the next 11 months pass, when Mordechai and all the Jews will be killed because the letter has been sent out to kill them next 13th day of Adar. No, he can't wait. So he's so anxious that against his better judgment, he's already constructed the gallows to be built to hang Mordechai, right? And he's now asking, after the fact, not a good move for Haman, for permission to kill Mordechai. And he's waiting outside, right? And he rustles in the bushes, makes noise. And the king is, who's there? Who goes there? And the guards come, and they bring Haman forth. It's 3:33 in the morning, right? So the king says, Haman, hey, I'm glad you're up. You came at a perfect time. I need your sagely advice. After all, everything you've told me up until this point in time, beginning with the edict against Vashti and what I should do with her, everything is by your design. You're Mr. Mamuchan. You're Mr. Preparation, after all. I need your advice. Tell me, what do I do to a person who I love so much, who deserves great honor, and I can't, on my own, think of how I should honor this great individual? So Haman, in his own mind, thinks, what? Must be speaking about me. So what does he ask for? Does he ask for the world? No. Does he ask for what you and I would ask for? Dollars. Nothing. Gold. He asked for a ride on a horse. Listen to the words of Haman. He says, Your Royal Highness, you know, take this individual, me, and put him on a horse that the king himself rides on. Dress him up in a crown belonging to the king and in garments worn by the king. Parade him through the streets and say, this is what's coming to a man who the king loves. So who does Haman think it's all coming to? Himself, of course, right? Oh my gosh, said Achashverosh, what a brilliant, brilliant reward. You shall take, and I can just see Haman going, you know, graciously bowing. You shall take Mordechai, the rabbi. You will do everything that you said you should do for Mordechai. You parade him. You take care of him. You be the announcer. Now, at that moment, of course, not only is Haman crushed, but he realizes in the recesses of his evil heart that it's over. As his wife tells him later, once you start to fall before the Jews, the only thing breaking your fall will be the ground. So you're gone. So at that moment, he is crestfallen, correct? But what did he ask for? Think of the profundity. He asked for an insane reward. I want a horse that the king rides on. Well, who's the king? He's not referring to Achashverosh. No. He's referring to the king of the world, God. I want God's horse, and I will ride the horse wearing the crown of God. He said exactly what number four source said, that the world is a horse, the power that we expend is analogous to a horse, and God is the rider. Haman saw himself as being capable of hopping up on the cumulative energy and horsepower that he himself had directed to kill the Jews. And he thought, oh my gosh, I, Haman, can ride God's, the king of kings' horse, and I will take all that energy that I expended to prepare to kill the Jews, and I'm going to use it against Mordechai and the Jews. But to his shock and amazement, when he gets up on the horse, what did he realize? You know what he realized? Have a look at number three. Why was Memuchan Haman? Because he was called Memuchan, meaning prepared, because he was prepared for destruction. He affected his own demise literally to the nth detail. Everything he put into place, God said, thank you so much, Mr. Haman. every single detail that you enacted, I'm going to use to destroy you with. That's why he's Mr. Preparation. He thought that he could expend copious amounts of energy, every little detail, right? From the day, the month, the manipulation of the king, the banishment of the old queen, the sequestering of an insane, paranoid king where the Jews can't get to him and revoke the letter is sent. Everything is perfect. Then I'm going to hang him in such a way. It's all perfect. There's only one small problem. Then a hapachu. It all turned about and went back, every single detail, to kill Haman. There's only one other person other than the queen who the king, Ahasuerus, used his royal edict, the power that had been given to him by Haman, to say off with someone's head without having to go and get congressional approval. Who's the only other person ever put to death? Haman himself! Haman gives him license and he uses a license to kill Haman. Right? Who's on the horse? Not Haman. Mordecai's on the horse. God's on the horse. God's taking the details. Oh, you want to build a gallows for Mordecai? Have a swinging good time yourself, Mr. Haman. Now, this is an amazing idea. But there's a little bit of a problem. Think about it. It's wonderful in terms of the concept that Haman got his just rewards. That Haman invented his reward and he created every detail that led to his demise is delicious. It's ironic. It is an ultimate poetic justice. Every detail, right? But there's one small problem. Think about it. If God is always the rider, and everything that I do as an individual, the energy, the horsepower that I put forth, if it is all taken by God, harnessed by God, little horse analogy there, and it's directed by God. So if I pray, for example, really, really hard for someone to feel better, but God takes my energy that I'm giving forth, my genuine prayer, my charity that I offer, and God says, I'm going to use it the way I want to use it. Then what place in this world is there for me? Because it seemingly nullifies individuality, doesn't it? Meaning, God has a plan, destiny, and we don't have any ability to affect any change within that plan. Seemingly. Do you hear that? Meaning, if everything we do, everything we expend, prayers, charity, goodwill, good actions, everything we do is going to be harnessed and used by God and directed by God, where does that leave room for me? So do you remember we had a question from number 5? What was the question? Why tell Esther, the queen, the reluctant Queen Esther, so don't go, Miss Queen. The Jewish people will be saved. Why would you tell that to the queen? You should say, no, we're desperate. We need you in our darkest hour. What was Mordecai saying? He's saying something remarkable, which answers this question, I believe. Look, Esther, if you think that God designed a world where the fate of the Jewish people is going to rest on your personal choice to go or not to go, you really think that's the way God designed the world? We are taught that God designed the world, Bereshit. In the beginning, that first word of the Bible, in the beginning, there's a play on words that says, Bishvil Reshit, for the nation called the first, the Jewish people, Shenikra Reshit. God created a world for the Jewish people to get the Torah, to become his chosen people. So you really think, Esther, that everything hinges on your little choice? How could it? Meaning, in the grand scheme of things, all I know, Mordecai says, is Haman's going to lose. We will win. But there's someone who will be lost in the fray. You know who that will be? You. You won't survive. Look what he says in number 5. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and rescue will arise for the Jews from elsewhere. Meaning the Jews will win the day somehow. Generically. Not through you. And you and your father's household will perish. This is amazing. Because within the universal, you have the local nested within the universal. You have a moment. The Jewish people are in peril. They need salvation. Casting call. Who wants to step up to the plate and save the Jews? Esther? You can answer the casting call and go in to see the king. But if you don't apply for the job, you will be a footnote in history. There won't be any Book of Esther. You'll be nothing. You'll be lost. There will never be a Megillat Esther. It'll be a book of someone else that will step up to the plate. We don't know who that person is. So therefore, it is so profound because it's telling us that there are universal truths, the destiny, and that God has woven into the fabric of history. But at the same time, God has opened up a place for us to be partners with Him in certain select areas of history, to choose to be involved or not to be involved. That is our individual choice to make it happen. In other words, what if it's not Moses, Aaron, and Miriam who lead the Jewish people out of Egypt? We know there still would have been Exodus. We know that the moment of Passover was at hand, the Jewish people were going to be freed. But if Moses really won the debate at the bush, and he said, no, I'm opting out, it won't be me, God, so there would be another Moses. That's the point of history, that God has destined certain momentous occasions to happen. But where do we fit in? Oh my gosh. We have to recognize the moment, step up to the plate, try out for the job, throw all our maximum energy and horsepower towards effecting change, and with God's help, we will merit being the new Esthers. So in this dark world that we spoke about, a world of Amalek, where the PR battle has been laid out in front of us, our own Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, laid it out very starkly for those of us who saw or heard his words last week that he spoke at Congress. It's up to us at this momentous occasion to step up to the plate, to be the vocal advocates for our beloved Israel, to protect Israel. And if Israel has to act unilaterally, we need to be there the day after Israel acts to step up and defend Israel because we know what's coming. That's our choice. We can choose to go to the king or not to go to the king. That's our individual choice. But one thing is for sure. Am Yisrael Chai. Make no doubt. Send a little message over to Rouhani and the Ayatollahs in Iran. They will not survive. We've been there before. We've done it. We won. It's going to happen again. Never doubt for a moment that the Jewish people will win the day. We will. We have to. It's part of God's design. The choice is ours, though, to be partners or not to be partners. So with God's help, no question should ever enter your mind whether the Jewish people in Israel will survive. That's a given. The only question is, what will our roles be in making the salvation happen? And with God's help, this month of Adar, the next Jewish month, Passover, Geula and Geula, one redemption after another will happen for us, for the American Jewish population, and especially Achenu Beit Yisrael Be'eretz Yisrael, our brothers and sisters of the house of Israel living in Israel. There will be Reva Fahatzalah. There will be this great turnabout, this great momentous deliverance. I thank you.